These days, when grown-ups need some escapist reading, many of us sneak into the kids' aisle. We dive into the world of YA, or young adult fiction. Well, if that describes you, or you actually are a young adult reader, writer Juliana Baggett has these five recommendations for you.
A good novel doesn't just transcend the boundaries of its target market. It knows nothing about target markets. Young readers have always reached above their reading level, and lately, we've seen adult readers reaching into the world of teen fiction in search of no-holds-barred storytelling. Here are five titles for summer reading that will appeal to readers across age groups. In Martin Bedford's novel Flip, the 14-year-old narrator Alex finds himself inhabiting the body of Flip, a charmer, athlete, and slacker who is foreign to Alex, who's never kissed a girl. Martin Bedford's novel portrays heartsick longing and tender relationships among family, friends, and first loves. In Lauren Oliver's Delirium, Lena Holloway lives contentedly enough in futuristic Portland, Maine, where a medical procedure cures people of deliria, aka love. In a world with a militaristic Pleasantville feel, evaluators make smart marital matches based on class. Haunted by the deliria-induced suicide of her mother, Lena toes the line. That is, until she meets a boy who knows what's beyond the electrical fences. Frances O'Rourke Dowell's 10 Miles Past Normal features Janie Gorman, a whip-smart, snarky, big-hearted narrator whose parents chucked suburbia for farm life. At 9, this delighted Janie. Now a hopelessly lost freshman, she smells like goat poop and she lunches in the library. Dowell offers the upside of embracing your own weirdness and barreling on with life. In the opening of Michael Northrup's Trapped, a tale of seven classmates trapped inside their high school during an epic blizzard, I thought, how bad can it get? Tensions build, however, as the snow does, accumulating in drifts, blocking windows, casting the story into darkness, and finally, this novel buries you. Northrup doesn't dive too deeply into a love story. As a result, with some parental vetting, Trapped might be a good read for middle schoolers who enjoy disaster tales. Kathy Ostler's Karma is a rich and unpredictable historical novel. Set in 1984, it begins with poetic diary entries from 15-year-old Maya, who is shattered by her mother's recent suicide. Half Hindu and half Sikh, Maya and her father fly to India with her mother's ashes. In the violent aftermath of Indira Gandhi's assassination, Maya is cast into the streets alone. Karma is a novel in verse that tells a whirlwind story with heartfelt emotion. Regardless of age, there's something to be pulled from each of these novels because some things never change. As it turns out, the search for self in this world is a lifelong one.
That's Juliana Baggett. She's the author of the forthcoming novel, Pure. You can find details about her reading recommendations along with other summer reading picks at our website. And please check out the summer books page at npr.org.
If you read novels by the popular fantasy writer Terry Pratchett, you encounter death. He's an actual character, the skeleton in the black hood, portrayed as not such a bad guy. So maybe it's not surprising that at age 63, Terry Pratchett speaks publicly of causing his own death. He's been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's.
I believe everyone should have a good death, not a death screaming. The ideal death, I think, is what was the ideal a Victorian death, you know, with your grandchildren around you, a bit of sobbing, and you say goodbye to your loved ones, making certain that one of them has been left behind to look after the shop.
Terry Pratchett has become an advocate for legalized assisted suicide in Britain, one of many voices in a debate that has spread to many countries. Many people oppose the practice for religious reasons or because they fear a slippery slope to involuntary euthanasia. We should warn you that over the next 6 minutes we'll hear Terry Pratchett talk of this dark subject the way that he writes, with gallows humor and the occasional profanity. He thinks of death even though he is soon to publish a new book called Snuff, and he's dictating two more books into a computer.
It's a speech-to-text module that you can put on your PC, and you talk to it. And it's saved my sanity, I think. It does mean, though, that I have to teach it new words, because it's an American product. In its original state, it doesn't have some, like arsehole, for example.
It doesn't have that. Well, we do have that word in the United States.
I'm fully aware. But
maybe we pronounce it differently here, and that's causing the problem.
But the whole thing is very clever. You can actually let it, it's fairly simple to get it to read your voice.
I just want to underline this for people. You're saying that because of your condition, you would have difficulty using a keyboard, even difficulty reading, and yet you are still, through dictation, writing.
Absolutely, yes. The difficulty with reading is nothing to do with the eyes, really. It's because the mechanism which allows you to, as it were, read through the page turn and still find your place doesn't work for me. It's a bit of a bugger, but it's not that much.
I think some people listening to you, and those of us who know someone with Alzheimer's, will be inspired in a way to hear that even though you have this difficulty, you're continuing on with your life's work and finding ways to adapt to your condition and move forward. And so perhaps it will at the same time surprise some people that you have become an advocate for assisted suicide and have spoken of suicide yourself. Why is that?
Yes. I prefer not to use the word suicide, because suicide is an irrational thing, whereas I think that for some people, asking for an assisted death is a very rational thing. People who I have met who have opted for it are very rational in their thinking. And indeed, so are their families quite often. Because they know they are in the grip of a terrible disease for which there is no cure. And they do not want to spend any more time than necessary in the jaws of the beast.
Is that your reasoning now?
Broadly speaking, yes.
How would you know when the right time is, if it's up to you?
Always a problem for someone with Alzheimer's. And regrettably, quite a few people go earlier than they might need to make certain that they are totally coherent when they're asked the various questions and fill in the various forms that they have to fill in.
Well, let's explain for those who do not know that you did a documentary at a clinic in Switzerland that assists people with suicide, a clinic called Dignitas.
That's right.
And you did watch the death of a man.
And I was an observer, yes.
How did they go about the death?
Well, several days beforehand, the person had to be in Switzerland and talk to doctors, where they explained to him what is going to happen. And if he agrees to all this and still has a firm purpose, then the last act is in the little room. Rather a pleasant little room, I have to say, if you don't know what it's used for, where he takes two potions. One is a potion to stop you chucking up the second one, and the other one's the poison that will kill you in a matter of a few seconds.
So you drink it like someone might drink hemlock in ancient Greece.
Yes, indeed. And all the while, the camera overhead is watching to make certain the helper does not force it on you. And indeed, this gentleman, being a very English gentleman, thanks everybody who was there for coming. And he drank of the drink, and very shortly after he died.
Doesn't this clinic also service a fair percentage of people who don't have any particular disease? They're simply described as weary of life.
Exactly so. I'm not standing up for them.
Now, this is interesting, because one of the great questions of a debate like this is, where exactly do you draw the line? And it sounds like you would draw the line farther than those who are completely opposed to assisted suicide, but you would draw a line. You're no fan of killing yourself because you're feeling depressed, for example.
Well, I would say to that, the reason I would not hold up the banner for that is that I've often felt depressed. Everyone feels depressed.
So in your mind, it would be acceptable to be assisted in that process if you have a terminal disease and you do not wish to endure it to the very end. That is, in your mind, is where you're at.
Exactly, yes.
Have you made a decision for yourself?
No. I would like to see assisted dying with a few changes which are, shall we say, suitable for the way the English do things, available in the UK. And I'm going to fight for that one. And I can't fight for that one if I'm dead.
Oh, meaning you still have work to do on assisted suicide, so it's not time to...
Well, I've got a lot of other work to do. As you pointed out very early on, you would speak to me thinking that I didn't have Alzheimer's. I have a rare form of Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
But shall you say, gives you a longer view before it really takes hold at its worst.
So you are an advocate of this, but you have not decided definitely to do it yourself when the time comes.
At the moment, I get about, I write books, and the new one, Snuff, is coming out, and people have read it so far, like it an awful lot, and that was written by me with no other help other than occasional secretarial help. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm a writer who's writing books, and therefore I don't want to die. You'd miss the end of the book, wouldn't you?
We certainly would.
You can't die with an unfinished book.
Terry Pratchett has completed many books, including his latest Snuff. We have an excerpt at NPR.org along with other NPR reporting on assisted suicide.
Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Kevin Wilson's new novel, The Family Fang. His 2009 short story collection, Tunneling to the Center of the Earth, was awarded the Shirley Jackson Prize, named in honor of the writer who gave us the very disturbing classic short story, The Lottery. Maureen says Wilson's own worldview is also somewhat off-kilter, but happily it's lightened with a lot of humor.
There's a temperature at which water boils, and there's a temperature at which the brain melts, and we've reached it. It's August, and almost everywhere in the country, it's hot. The will to think, to focus, has oozed out in millions of droplets of forehead sweat. That's why it's such a minty fresh delight to open up Kevin Wilson's debut novel, The Family Fang, and feel the revitalizing blast of originality, robust invention, screwball giddiness. Every copy of The Family Fang sold in August should have a sticker on it, imprinted with the life-giving invitation that used to be issued on movie marquees in summertime during the dawn of the air conditioning age. Come on in. It's cool inside. Meet the Family Fang. Caleb and Camille Fang, that odd last name was supposedly shortened from something Slavic at Ellis Island, are renowned husband and wife conceptual artists. They've won a slew of awards, even the MacArthur Genius Prize. For years, they've been videotaping transgressive, improvisational pieces that involve their children, Annie and Buster, known to fans of Fang art as Child A and Child B. To give an example, in a 1985 piece called The Last Supper, the Fangs take their then-young kids to the most expensive French restaurant in town. All their parents tell Buster and Annie are the dread words that the events to come will be fun. Throughout dinner, the Fang parents are utterly silent, but keep checking their watches. The children become increasingly tense, especially Buster, who's been ordered at the outset to finish every scrap of the shimmering piece of purple liver on his plate. Finally, the suspense gets to Buster's intestines, and he projectile vomits what Wilson describes as the dark red remains of a shredded animal across the white tablecloth. The fancy dining room erupts in cries of disgust, and the Fangs leap up and rush their children out to the parking lot, of course also skipping out on the check. Speeding away in the family van, the Fang parents congratulate their children for unknowingly collaborating on another great piece of art that disrupts the world, makes it vibrate. As you might expect, there comes a time in teenagehood when Annie and Buster refuse to be manipulated any longer as props in their parents' artistic happenings. I won't give anything away. I'll just tell you that the rift occurs after a hilariously incestuous high school performance of Romeo and Juliet. In the present time of the novel, however, Annie and Buster, as adults, have had to return to their parents' house, seeking refuge there from life's catastrophes. Annie, a Hollywood actress, has been devastated by a mean publicity campaign. Buster, a writer, has been seriously wounded in the face while on a freelance magazine assignment. The Fang parents aren't faring so well either. Historically, most of their performance pieces took place in shopping malls, where a ready audience of shocked onlookers could always be found. But these days, so many folks wall themselves off with earbuds and iPhones that the Fangs' recent spectacles have fallen flat. As Caleb Fang laments, "People have become so stupid that you can't control them." Camille agrees, "They are so resistant to any strangeness that they tune out the whole world. God, it's so damn depressing." Uneasily reunited in the family house, licking their life wounds, the younger Fangs have to reckon with the price of Caleb and Camille's narcissistic core belief that art, if you loved it, was worth any amount of unhappiness and pain. This premise could easily have devolved into pop psychodrama, but think instead of something like Little Miss Sunshine, a family story that's out of the box and funny and also genuinely moving. Wilson's inventive genius never stops for a rest break. He spins out entertaining scenarios for the Fang performance pieces, as well as loony summaries for Buster's novels and Annie's movies, as well as what unfolds as the present time suspense plot of the disappearance of Caleb and Camille. Is it genuine, or is it yet another Fang performance piece? Early on in the novel, we're told that the art the Fangs create has been glowingly described by critics as choreographed spontaneity. Wilson might as well have been writing a review for his own strange and wonderful novel, for The Family Fang indeed reads as a work of choreographed spontaneity that will linger in your mind long after the mall has closed and the mess in the restaurant has been cleaned up.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Family Fang by Kevin Wilson. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Peter Spiegelman loves a good caper. Well, he did work on Wall Street for 20 years before becoming a writer, but he says the inspiration for his new novel, Thick as Thieves, are some of the classic caper films in which people, under pressure, race to make a lot of money and always wonder whom they can really trust.
I need you to bridge some burglar alarms, open doors, cut some telephone circuits. I got a job laid out.
You want to knock over a casino? Three casinos?
You got to be nuts.
Exactly.
$150 million.
Smash and grab job, huh?
Slightly more complicated than that.
Top Capi is an impregnable fortress. Those emeralds are watched day and night.
So over here in this room, you can take $100 million off the wall and waltz right out the front door. That's good.
Signature lines from The Anderson Tapes, Ocean's 11, Top Cappy, and The Thomas Crown Affair. Peter Spiegelman has written three thrillers since leaving Wall Street 9 years ago. He's been acclaimed for bringing some of the hands-on expertise and literary grace that John le Carré brought to espionage novels to stories of capers, heists, and double crosses. Peter Spiegelman joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Is there anything we'd see in a caper film that winds up in your book?
I love the sound bites that you selected. They're from some of my favorite films. And I think the vibe, you know, more than anything else, I think what I was trying to capture here is the vibe of the exotic, the paranoid, of that tension that is constantly ratcheting up, of people who are, you know, wrestling in their own ways with that central question of whether or not there is honor among thieves.
The target at the center of your story is Curtis Prager, and he's rich and corrupt. How does he make his money?
He had been a sort of storied hedge fund manager. His hedge fund went south under allegations of fraud and the general market collapse. But rather than being chastened by any of that, he sort of embraced his inner pirate and got into a business that ostensibly is about buying small bank and trust companies, consolidating their operations, consolidating their back offices that he runs from the Cayman Islands. What he's actually involved in is providing a kind of a financial superstore for black money. So he does everything from money laundering to investments to shell corporations.
I've got to ask you while we have the opportunity here. It seems to me that in recent years, not just since 2008, people who work on Wall Street in the financial services industry are often the bad guys in police procedurals.
Sure. You know, I think the sort of rip from the headlines impulse makes them a pretty easy target. And of course, you know, sadly, there are many examples of, of wrongdoing.
Yeah. Well, based on your experience, is that a stereotype?
Wow. I think about the famous Willie Sutton line of, you know, that's where the money is, right?
Yeah, Willie Sutton said he was asked, why do you rob banks? And he said, that's where the money is.
Yeah. I think like so many other phenomena, you know, you can look to the bell-shaped curve, normal distribution, and the people that you find on Wall Street, you know, probably fall into that curve pretty well. I think, you know, at one end, there are people who you could trust in a room with a pile of uncounted money and never think twice that any of it would go missing. Mm-hmm. And at the other end of the spectrum, there are people who, no matter what the safeguards, will always try and game the system. And in the middle is the vast bulk of people who are mostly, under most circumstances, pretty honest. And if the proper regulations and the proper safeguards are in place, are not going to do any more wrong than anybody in any other field. What makes Wall Street interesting, however, and especially on the trading side of things, is you have an industry that has selected and filtered to create a population of people who are very good at coming out on top of zero-sum games. I mean, that's what trading is. You know, it's a zero-sum game. Someone wins and someone loses. And investment banks go out of their way to find people who are really good at playing those games. So the notion that those people, or at least some of those people, aren't going to try and game the compensation system, you know, it's at best a kind of naive notion.
You went to Vassar and won some poetry prizes there.
I did.
So how'd you wind up on Wall Street?
Well, I wrote poetry as an undergraduate, and I was very serious about it and was sort of a hair's breadth away from pursuing an MFA, going into an MFA program. And sort of the 11th hour, I sobered up and realized, you know, I had to pay the rent and I needed to make some money. I actually started in the software business. Mm-hmm. Besides studying English at Vassar, I took a lot of math and science courses, physics courses, some computer science courses. So the quantitative side of my education had, you know, had been well taken care of. And I found a job actually down in D.C. with a small consulting firm that had government contracts, did public policy research, and did big data analyses and statistical analyses on large government databases. That's how I got started.
Mm-hmm. So what happened? Did you rediscover literature or your desire to?
I had never really, lost my interest in it. I, have always been an avid reader and a writer. And really throughout my time on Wall Street and in software, I had written and had been writing poetry and had always been, from a very young age, a fan of crime fiction. And had always thought that, I'd want to try my hand at this. You know, I thank my lucky stars, actually, that I did not go into an MFA program then. Nothing against MFA programs. I was just so young and so inexperienced. And while, I might have had some talent and even some craft, I really have no idea what I would have had to say. You know, I think just, 20 years of some life experience and 20 years of hanging out on trading floors was actually pretty good education for somebody who's interested in watching people and interested in how they behave under pressure and interested in writing crime fiction.
Peter Spiegelman, his new novel, Thick as Thieves. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now we have a remembrance of a prolific author whose work straddled genres from romance to crime to fantasy to graphic novels and nonfiction. Celebrated and best-selling author Leslie Esdale Banks passed away earlier this month after a battle with cancer. She was 51 years old. She wrote more than 40 books, and her friends remember a rare beauty who could charm a whole bookstore or a room with her strength of spirit. Banks used a variety of pen names during her career, but her many fans knew her best as L.A. Banks. That's the name she used for her popular novels about werewolves and vampires that predated the Twilight and True Blood novels. Her popular series Vampire Huntress featured a female African-American protagonist, something you just don't see every day in fantasy fiction. To talk more about the life and works of Leslie Esdale Banks, I'm joined by another acclaimed African-American writer, novelist Tanana Reeve. Her upcoming book is My Soul to Take. Welcome to the program, and we're so sorry for the loss of your friend.
Oh, yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for doing the show and giving me a chance to talk about Leslie.
Actually, tell us a little bit about her. She was tall. She was fabulous. She filled a whole room.
Yeah, you know all of it already. She was. She was, she was tall in the sense that, yes, I'm short, so everyone's tall to me. But she was big in spirit, in love. There are so many writers who remember her laugh most about her, but that was just Leslie, just so full of joy and just so eager to spread it.
You loved her a lot.
I did. I did not get to see her as much as I would have liked. We were on different coasts, but we were part of a very small literary circle, and we met through that literary circle of Black fantasists and Black speculative fiction writers. And so, yes, we definitely just fell into each other.
Talk to us a bit about her writing for the people that aren't familiar with her novels. Why did fans connect with her so strongly?
Well, I knew from the very first time a manuscript came across my desk for a book called Minion that this writer, L.A. Banks, as the name said, was going to be a star because she knew how to write those page turners. She knew she could tap into that love of the paranormal that we share to sort of dazzle us with the possibilities. But that's just, just the beginning of a very long and prolific career.
I've got to ask you, Damon Williams at the Philadelphia Daily News said her fingerprints were all over the True Blood series, that current HBO hit about the vampires battling real-life issues, all right, and the werewolves and witches right now, but that's a whole nother issue. And I've seen comments by some of her fans wondering why her novels weren't getting the same level of so-called mainstream adulation as those in the Twilight novels. What do you think? Is it still about Black writers being pigeonholed and not seen as a true part of this genre?
It's a sad thing to have to confront, and I think I've also confronted it in my own work because I've also had works optioned, and it's a long, difficult road no matter what kind of story it is. It's a miracle any movie ever gets made. Mm-hmm. But definitely, when you're writing about characters of color, you're going to face an even higher hurdle. And I would think that, yes, it's no wonder that another kind of story based on European characters could leapfrog past characters of color, because so often in the film industry they talk about the international model, will it sell in Asia? It's not like it was in the 70s when they made Shaft and they could really create movies and be profitable making movies specifically for Black audiences. Now, some filmmakers, Tyler Perry can do that. He has a very specific audience. Mm-hmm. He has yet to make a supernatural thriller. Hopefully, maybe one day he will, but it is. It's very, very difficult. I can't say definitively that's the only reason, but I don't think you have to look a lot farther.
Let me ask you really quickly, because we are really short on time. Can you give us, for readers who haven't seen it, a really short, just tell me the opening of Minion, because that's the thing that grabs people.
Well, Minion is pitting the forces of good and evil. You have Damali, who's a spoken word artist, but she's also a vampire huntress, and it's her job. She's been given this task every 1,000 years to fight the forces of evil. And what's beautiful about it also is that she's also a spoken word artist. So Leslie was bringing this funky kind of energy into the story, not just the same good and evil riff, but something that would really touch young readers and move young readers because she was speaking their language with the spoken word and wrapping it all up together into a team to fight the vampires and the forces of evil.
What will you miss most about Leslie?
Oh, boy.
We
spoke so much about her as a writer. And, of course, I love Leslie as a writer, but really it's just that beautiful human spirit she had. If I look at two of the most generous people I've known, not just writers, in the past few years, it would be Elin Harris, who passed away, and Leslie. You know, it's like the shiniest fruit, the sweetest fruit, get plucked first. And that, even now, I know it's been some days since she died, but it's just such a shock still that I really don't believe it. So I will miss her spirit, her laughter, just that rapid fire. You send her an email, she's sending it back right away. She's always there, ready to answer questions, ready to share. Just all of her spirit is what I'll miss.
Novelist and American Book Award-winning author Tanana Reeve Due joined us from Atlanta, Georgia, from the studios of Georgia Public Radio. Her latest book, My Soul to Take, her 10th novel, will be published in September. Thanks again, and again, our condolences for your loss.
No, thank you so much.